Hello everyone and welcome to the EdTech Podcast. My name is Sophie Bailey and this week I'm super excited to delve into the world of play. Before that, thank you all for the amazing feedback on the Future Tech for Education series. Here's some of your comments to date. Shane McLaughlin, I'm sure that's how you pronounce your name, said, "Hi Sophie, I love your podcast on AI and education. Really fascinating stuff. Do you think it's a waste of time to teach students code if in a few years' time AI will be able to carry out the coding in the place of humans?" Well, Shane, I do think we should be careful to not obsess over the technique and rather focus our attentions perhaps on the computational thinking behind it. There's lots of chat currently ongoing about why we need to bring back the humanities into our discussions around technology. Here is what I say. Next up, Alina Sinel said, "What a great podcast. If you do another podcast on AI, do please let me know, and I could recommend a few teens who are AI researchers. One is 15 and doing a master's in machine learning, and another one is the youngest researcher at King's College London's AI lab." Thanks, Alina. Nothing like making us older listeners feel a little bit past it. I'd love to get those young AI whippersnappers involved in a future episode. Yes, please. And finally, Karen Trickey, a PhD researcher and currently at UCL Knowledge Lab, shared how she got into the EdTech podcast in the first place about a year ago. She said, "A regular walker, I fell upon your podcast while searching for field-relevant, broad-in-scope EdTech innovation ones. Initially because I was looking for ways to better support my hour-long walks to work and back, as not just physically beneficial, but equally to allow me to catch up on topics, make connections between ongoing interesting initiatives for work, and critically think about others. On that note, very much appreciate them and the work you do." So thank you very much, Karen, and I do love how with podcasts you can change a functional journey into a learning experience to kickstart your day. We'll be back with the rest of the Future Tech for Education series in January. Thanks for all your feedback and do keep it coming in via email, Twitter or record a quick message at www.speakpipe.com/the EdTech podcast. Margaret Pickford, an EdTech specialist and teacher from the north of the UK, did just that to comment on our Future of Work episode just out.
"Hi, my name is Margaret Pickford. I work in technology and education for about 35 years as an IT trainer and also as a computer science teacher. I'm 58 and I'm fed up of employers always poaching technically capable staff from other employers and not bothering to retrain their own. I also resent the fact that not many employers will consider employing somebody who's over 55, and I want to know what steps they're going to use to address that gap in the market, considering they all say they've got an IT skills shortage, but they're not going to be willing to train their own."
Thanks, Margaret. Seems like there is a disconnect between the idea of lifelong learning and the reality of employability and skilling up. I know this is something my mother-in-law also talks about. She originally trained under the now legendary Dame Stephanie Shirley. And if anyone out there can help Margaret or has new ideas on this theme, then do please get in touch. Right, now back on with this week's episode on play. Along with dolphins, we humans love play. In a paper by M.V. Scarf in 1962 entitled "Play is Education," Einstein is quoted as saying, "The desire to arrive finally at logically connected concepts is the emotional basis of a vague play with basic ideas. This combinatory or associative play seems to be the essential feature in productive thought." Everyone's had that aha moment in the shower when random thoughts seem to click into place when we least expected them. Isn't this the same with play when unforced thinking arrives at some of our best ideas? Play-based learning is gaining popularity, drawing on elements of project and games-based learning, peer-to-peer and real-world learning. But what really is it? More recent explorations of play-based learning have been conducted by Teresa Kremin, Professor of Education at the Open University, with papers like "International Cross-Cultural Play" and "Creative Early Years Scientists." But large swathes of play-based learning appear to rest on past pedagogies of constructivism. Are these pedagogies still relevant, or is it time for new approaches to play-based learning?
At our school, we have kind of three major focus areas that guide our curriculum and kind of our culture as well, which are project-based learning as one, oracy as another, and then well-being. So developing within those three, children through their head, which is the intellectual side, heart, which is them as a person, and then hand, which is their ability to craft and create.
That's Anna Kirk, Head of Curriculum Development for Primary at School 21, an award-winning free school set in East London.
Thank you.
So first up, could you tell us a little bit about you and also your role at School 21, just to start?
So I have been a teacher for, this is my 11th year now, and I've been working at School 21 for the last three, I'm into my third, and I'm on the senior leadership team here, but I'm also responsible for kind of overseeing project-based learning from reception and up through the older years of primary into our middle school as well, as that develops. So I consult with all of the teams that are working on projects and keep my finger on the pulse of the quality and the range and the breadth and the depth of the learning going on as well. So in a nutshell, that's my role at the moment.
And I can detect a bit of an accent in there. So have you taught elsewhere as well before this?
I have. I studied and trained in Australia and I taught there for 3 years before moving over to the UK. I've worked in Newham the whole time I've lived here, which was since 2008. I worked in quite a traditional school just down the road for about 8 years before moving here.
Yeah, and I've been following what's going on in Melbourne and in Victoria, especially with education innovation, seems to be really interesting.
Yeah, the states in Australia are really separate. So my experience was in Queensland, but okay. I know that there's definitely from networking and connections we've got here, we've had visitors to our school from Australia who have been interested in bringing Oracy to the forefront of their practice and things like that. So I think there definitely is the movements happening there as well, which is exciting.
Yeah. In terms of play-based learning, what does play-based learning mean to you?
To me, I think it's an important part of learning because it just gives ownership of the learning over to the young people that are engaged in it. And I think that, traditionally you think of play-based learning and you think of early years immediately, but I actually think there's room for it throughout the curriculum because of that ownership, because it almost takes the lid off learning because, it's exploration based. It's down to your imagination and your own creativity as the learner. And then it's the part of the teacher in that experience is that they take the role of a facilitator and they put scaffolding in and arrange environments that lead to that creative thinking. So I think that there's definitely a place for it no matter what age you are. And I think it feeds into our projects a lot at School 21, the exploratory nature of it.
And could you give us an example of some of the projects that you're currently working on that sort of reflect some of these ideas as well?
Yeah, some of the strongest projects I've been involved with that are good examples, I think, are a year three project that we did recently called the essential question was, how can we bring our toys to life? So the product children were working on was a toy which they designed completely themselves, and then they had components of it that were electric, that lit up or moved or made sound or a combination of all three. And so the learning around that was science-based, but I think science especially lends itself to an exploratory kind of focus because we just gave the children everything they might use to build circuits and a whole lot of other things as well. And they just had a free, session of just exploring what they could do and what they could make and what happened when they connected different parts and without a lot of pre-teaching from us, just to see what they came up with. And they, independently built some quite complex circuits and some of them developed their own switches and things like that without, we weren't the owners of that knowledge. They discovered that through playing with all this equipment, which was really exciting to see. And then they were teaching each other. So it really empowered them to be learners as well as holders of the information and teaching others. Then another example might be we did a project last year in year four called What Would a Museum of the Future Be Like, where the children made replicas of ancient artifacts from the Mayan civilization and then photograph these and put them in a virtual reality environment, which it looked like they were walking around in ancient times looking at these artifacts. But the artifacts themselves, we ended up purchasing a whole lot of modeling materials and art things and just having a kind of free flow afternoon of the children experimenting and playing and seeing what they could build. So giving them kind of scaffolding around what the product would be, but then that freedom to just explore and play and build and see what worked and what didn't, and then make decisions from that too going forward in the project. So I think those are two examples of where that kind of open nature of the facilitation of a session can really lead to some really deep learning.
And for other people that would like to experiment and kind of employ more play-based or project-based learning techniques, what's your advice in terms of how to go about measuring the impact of some of those as well? So some of the studies, for example, have either been quite dated or focused on the US. So do you have any ways of sort of going about measuring those that you would recommend to others?
Yeah, I'd have to say, like, a huge benefit of planning and facilitating experiences like that is that you're not the one working hard, if that makes sense. It's the children that are doing the hard work, which I think is what education should kind of be. And it allows you as the teacher to really sit back and observe and watch really carefully and listen to the interactions these children are having, the language they're using, the questions they're asking and forming themselves. So I think that in a single session, a standalone session, is super powerful, because it might be that you don't get that time when you're leading the lesson and you're making sure that you might be working with a focus group. Whereas if it is everybody involved in a task you've facilitated, you've set up and scaffolded, you can really watch and observe. So that's one way. But then I think the longer term impact of that is, you know, at an end of a session, you have the children kind of, again, leading the pace of the learning. And then you build on what you've observed into the project. And then the next lesson might take a completely different turn to what you'd planned out, because you notice that, you know, through this exploratory session, children have worked out A, B, and C. So instead of you having to explicitly teach that, you can now, you know, better build on where they actually are. So I think that's important in the project sense. Yeah. But then overall as well, I think that the most impactful learning that I've seen, that then, you know, when you do more traditional testing and assessment protocols, like, you know, written tests and you have feedback sessions with the children, you know, it's those sessions that stick with the children as well. And so that learning is what they remember, because it's learning that they kind of directed themselves. Yeah.
That's really interesting. So the actual techniques give you a bit more space for reflection, and yeah. So the pedagogies that I've seen that sort of underpin a lot of this seem to be around sort of the constructivism and that kind of thing. Are there any new techniques or new pedagogies that you hear about that are more up to date, or how do you kind of go about sharing your techniques and learning and inspiring your teaching methodology in this area as well?
Yeah, a big link here. So at our school, we have kind of three major focus areas that guide our curriculum and kind of our culture as well, which are project-based learning as one, oracy as another, and then well-being. So developing within those three, children through their head, which is the intellectual side, heart, which is them as a person, and then hand, which is their ability to craft and create. So those three linking in together, I think, really help, and I think they lend themselves to sort of the development of those exploratory experiences as well. So, you know, explicitly raising the profile of oracy so children are confident in sharing their ideas, in asking questions, in communicating and collaborating and disagreeing respectfully is really important when you're, you know, watching a session where their interactions and their collaboration are kind of guiding the learning. So I think, you know, there's kind of a big swell of oracy, as, you know, and its importance and its profile is rising through the work that, you know, our school has done and lots of other schools now around the UK are doing. And I think that's a really integral part of how that kind of learning within project-based learning and every other aspect of the curriculum, if I'm honest, is really being elevated as well, because, you know, that ability to speak and to communicate and to have your voice and to debate your view and to be heard is really important in that context as, you know, while you're learning. Yeah.
It's massive. I mean, I would love to come and take part in your oracy program, to be honest, because, you know, it's such a huge skill. The other thing is, so as part of that, is there sort of like a national oracy event that the children can take part in? Or
there's lots of things going on. We have lots of amazing partnership schools now that are working with our charity Voice 21 and our school, and so there's lots of things going on, and it really has taken off. So it's been amazing to see it, because it's just been in the few short years that I've been here too that I've seen the kind of push. As far as what we're doing here, we're organizing events ourselves as a pioneer school to kind of bring together all this amazing practice around the country. So our we have exhibitions of beautiful work each term, and next term in spring we're aiming towards making that completely oracy based, so all our projects will be geared towards with a you know rich RSC outcome, but we're also opening that up to anyone else who wants to come to that and be involved. And it's going to be beyond just children sharing what they've done. It will also be, you know, opportunity for networking between educators and between, and you know, having other schools come in and share their amazing practice as well. So yeah, it's exciting. So that's on the drawing board at the moment. We're working that one out. So yeah, but there are lots of things going on from lots of the schools that we've been working with who are really kind of taking the innovation reins and running with what they're doing at their schools too, which is really fantastic to see.
And finally, do you have any books, resources or people that have inspired your learning in this area? So I know you're on Twitter. Are there any other things that have really kind of kicked off some of these thoughts in your head as well?
Yeah, coming to work at this school, it made me realise that the elements of project-based learning that I love and that I really think are how children should be taught and how I love to teach are kind of in my practice already. So, and then it was kind of coming here that let me kind of shape that into a better formed vision. And some of the stuff that we learn about here is, you know, all the stuff going on in the US, Perlman stuff and their innovation in project-based learning, High Tech High. I would totally recommend anyone check out their website and their philosophy behind education, because they've been somebody that's been influential in our school's development. We had John Bosselman, who had worked there, come and work with us in the early years, and I missed that sadly, but he's still spoken about very fondly. And our school has worked as well with the Innovation Unit, who's also helped kind of develop our vision. But yeah, and then there's lots of just schools that are trying it out. And the best thing that I've found about networking with other schools who are developing their own PBL is that it is their own. It's kind of a different flavor with similarities wherever you go, which is really interesting to see how people take that, you know, that pedagogy and develop it and make it their own. So that's been great too. So there's lots of schools around. I'd just recommend anyone get onto Twitter and search out projects and PBL and connect with anybody.
Thanks, Anna. What about outside of schools? In Denmark, one of the world's biggest brands on play is getting serious about education. Denmark is an interesting case study. The Danish school system is influenced by N.F.S. Grundtvig, the ideological founder of the folk high school movement in Denmark since the 19th century. His opposition to exams as being destructive for creative thinking is still evident in the Danish quote-unquote fail-free system. Indeed, play is in Denmark evident through the popularity of projects like LARPing at the Ofteskof Efterskole, where learning is conducted entirely through role-play. So which is the brand on play we are talking about, which soaks up all this history and culture around free thinking? It's Lego, of course.
The word Lego actually is a combination of the words play well from Danish.
That's Tom Hall, General Manager for Education at Lego.
Hi, Sophie. Thanks for having me.
So please, can you tell us a little bit about your role at Lego?
Sure. Well, I am the Managing Director of our international Lego education business. And we have teams based around the world managing our business everywhere from China to Europe, Japan and Korea. We're pretty much everywhere. We produce STEM learning solutions based around the iconic Lego brick. We create curriculum and training. And most of our solutions have a coding element now. So I think that we are pretty wonderfully sort of packaging the physical brick with the digital learning languages of the future, and that's going into our products.
This week's episode is on play-based learning. So what does play mean to Lego?
I think it's everything. I think it means everything for us. I've learned nothing from Danish as a language, apart from a couple of clips. And one of them is that the word Lego actually is a combination of the words play well from Danish. So it's there in the DNA. I think the entire focus of the company, everything that the designers and the creatives and our leadership team is thinking about here is about delighting, inspiring kids to play and be creative and tinker. I think that's really consistent everywhere you go across Lego, whether we're talking about the retail business or Lego Foundation or Lego Education. You see the play element in the working environment. I'm sat in a room now with just huge, giant Lego models in the corner. There's bricks all over the table. There's lots of kind of quirky fun everywhere. And I think practically, play is really important in how we think about listening to children. We have advisory boards of kids coming in and informing our executive leadership team on things. The company has annual play days where we literally go and play as colleagues. So I think they sort of live and breathe the play theme very seriously. In my education business, play for us means learning. I think it's about children learning to express themselves. It's about learning how to work in teams, using your hands to build millions of potentially unique ideas. So you see that play reflected in product design and how we think about learning models. I see it when I kind of have seen the founding family here, the Kurt Christiansens, who own Lego. The third generation grandson is Kjeld, and you watch him talking about play and his eyes twinkle when he talks about it. And I think it's just infectiously baked into everything that stands around this company. So yeah, I think it's everything. It's in the name, but it's also in everything that we focus on from a product development and everything we think about in learning styles.
And from that point of view, obviously 2017 has seen huge focus on efficacy in education, educational technology. So how do we go about measuring some of the impact of that play as well?
I think that's a great question. And as you know, I came from Pearson and I was there when the efficacy model was really being designed and adopted across all of the company in terms of product development. So it's a word that means a lot to me. I think it's an interesting question when you talk about the impact of play in education, because the word measure in itself is quite a loaded one. I think play leads to creativity. Play leads to teamwork, to project skills. Through that playful process, children learn to sort of try and fail, to test and tinker. By using their hands to sort of play with the bricks, children learn about self-regulation, about efficiency. We start to develop perspective. We learn to sort of self-assess ourselves. You know, did that work? If not, can I try something again? We develop all of this spatial awareness. We develop our fine motor skills. And I think those skills are hugely relevant to our development as people and how we get ready for the future. So measuring those skills would make a lot of sense. I saw some really great data recently from, I think, a Fast Company review of 1,600 CEOs and sort of public, private and public leaders. And the questions had been, you know, what do you look for in your top talent hires? You know, what are the key skills that you're looking for and capabilities? And the massive priority answer was creativity. It's the number one thing. I think 60% of respondents said creativity. So I think it's really interesting that the end result of an education should be about finding relevant and rewarding work. And employees are telling us that they need creativity in order to match people with jobs. Then surely, you know, play and creativity is absolutely essential in getting those jobs. But I think, sadly, our sort of traditional education model just doesn't or isn't currently wired to prioritize creativity. Tests don't test for creativity. Teaching methods actually struggle to encourage and generate creativity the further we go up the education chain. So I think when you say the word measure, the sad truth is our education system doesn't really know how to measure creativity, which is a real juxtaposition, because the employment and job world needs creativity. And as we put people further and further through the education chain, we actually squeeze out creativity as they go through that process. So I think you can say, in terms of measuring the impact of play in education, it's completely essential for building the skills that are needed for the jobs of the future. I do think that an education system as it stands today really struggles to measure that impact and act on it.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're right at the beginning of, well, this alternative assessment without tests, using AI to have sort of continual assessment, or certainly starting to rank collaborative work. But yeah, it seems to be very much at the beginning of that process currently.
Completely agree. And I think it's exciting. I think our Lego Foundation does amazing work on this topic. I think looking at the impact of learning through play is our top priority to create, you know, engaged, joyful, happy children, but also create lifelong learners who want to keep developing themselves. So I do think that, you know, we're going to face some really interesting discussions around how to start testing for creativity, and also how to foster it and grow it in an education system that currently really struggles to keep that spark alive.
And so with some of your work in that area, do you have particular international case studies where you're seeing amazing things happen around play-based education and using Lego? Just trying to work out where some of those joyful experiences are happening currently.
Well, very happily for me, it's everywhere. So we have really exciting stories, and I can think of specific ones. You know, China, we train thousands of teachers per year focused around our principles of playful learning. I was in Austria the week before last, where we've just opened an innovation studio in a brand new school that's very much focused on teaching children how to build and make and developing that those sort of tinkering and maker skills. Russia, we have really incredible partnerships with ministries of education where after-school centres for kids, you know, after the traditional school day, they're going and spending time in state-funded after-school centres and they're learning to program and code. So, you know, it's everywhere, including the UK and beyond. And I think that different governments are at different stages in how they prioritise STEM. I saw some really great data yesterday that Ireland and their Ministry of Education is really starting to push the STEM agenda. I think we need to see governments take this really seriously before we can expect to see meaningful growth in schools. There's lots of really amazing things happening in emerging markets, in more mature markets. That's what makes this job really fun. We get to see a great range of different models in different languages. The wonderful thing is, you know, the language of the brick is consistent everywhere. And I think the coding languages that we're teaching and using are also consistent. So it allows us to cross borders really nicely.
And on the coding front, which languages do you tend to work with?
So we've had both proprietary and open source. So we're heavily focused on Scratch for next year. And of course, that opens up just huge communities to work with us in Python. So I think we're kind of meeting our kids and learners where they are on their learning stages, block-based and script-based coding skills. It's really exciting.
Having researched this episode, one thought that came to mind was that, you know, a lot of the play-based learning ideologies and sort of fringe theories, I suppose, as well. So games-based learning, peer-to-peer, etc. A lot of the pedagogy that underpins that appears to be around the constructivist movement, which is now probably about 50 or 60 years old. So I wondered if Lego follows any newer pedagogies or whether those are still relevant, and how that fits in with our new focus on creativity as a premium skill as many other things become automated, but just the sort of pedagogies that underpin what you do as well.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And Seymour Papert, the founder of Constructivism, was at the heart of the team that created Lego Education, and his ethos still runs deep in our thinking and the language we use here. So there's nothing I've seen recently or read that really is any newer or more relevant than Seymour Papert. He was writing about hands-on learning, creating coding languages more than 30 years ago. Those things are very much the backbone of our beliefs and our products at Lego Education today. I think whatever the technology advances, his theory still stands. And in my previous role at Pearson, when we were focused on product development, and I led product development for schools and English businesses, I'm, you know, very honestly, we were still looking at Seymour Papert. We were referencing him in our product design concepts. I've seen really incredible product designers talk very effusively and brilliant about modern technologies. But I think going back to his very much focus on hands-on and coding languages, he had amazing insights into children's thinking and learning. I think he recognized very early on, way ahead of the game, that computers could be used not just to deliver information and instruction, but also to empower children to experiment, to build, express themselves. So seeing that 30, 35 years later, 50, 60 years later, I think it still stands. It's very rich. When I look at our product design models moving forwards, I can still see plenty of great examples of constructivism. So I think it still stands the test of time. And he wrote brilliantly.
Okay, and then finally, so my question that I always ask everyone on the podcast, are there any books, people, resources that inspire you in this area?
Oh, that's a great question. I always enjoy this question on your podcast, and I am genuinely a listener. So I love learning about other people's books and topics that inspire them. I find podcasts just a very meditative way of switching off and focusing. So I enjoy this. I enjoy a bit of Harvard Business Review for a complete alternative and not necessarily on topic. I adore Desert Island Discs. I love listening to people's life stories, getting a bit of insight into what made them kind of either achieve or overcome. So love a good podcast. I'm a big mindfulness fan, and I read around that subject. I think there's a great sort of handbook by Dr. Mark Williams, the 9-week course in it. I keep dipping in and out of that. A really good introduction to the subject of all people is Ruby Wax. And I think she wrote a great sort of starter book on mindfulness. And I think on the subject of skills, I looked at my bedside table before coming to this conversation. And the one that I've got next is The 100-Year Life. I'm totally blanking on
Dr. Linda Grattan.
There you go. She's done some great TED Talks, and I am just starting that. I really like the fact that we are rethinking our working life, rethinking how we kind of need to constantly upskill ourselves and rethink where we are in sort of our learning journey. So yeah, I'm onto that next. And then I think real people, you know, I love spending time with teachers wherever I'm traveling. I kind of make it a condition of a trip of time well used will mean I've spent time in a classroom in whatever language and sort of watched how they're using our products. And of course, very lively EdTech chat on Twitter. Never a dull moment. I really love that mix of experience and insights. So I follow quite an eclectic group of voices on there.
Thanks, Tom. Much of play appeals to the natural curiosity of us as learners, but how do we design services and lessons around this curiosity, allowing for experimentation to supersede supercilious planning? Jamie Brooker is the founder of Kahoot. Kahoot has over 50 million active monthly players and is a meme sensation, but Brooker is passionate about the pedagogical underpinnings of its success. At We Are Human, he is now focused on bringing more human-centered design to education and other areas of social impact. But what does this mean, and why is it relevant to play-based learning?
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So first up, what does play-based learning mean to you?
When we founded Kahoot, we had this phrase, play is our first language. And, you know, anyone who looks at a newborn baby, they're learning, but they can't speak. And their way of learning about the world around them, who they are, who everyone else is, and this kind of strange place they've just ended up in, knows they're doing that through play, really, because it's about exploration. It's about curiosity. And really, it's about experimentation. It's about, like, trying to figure what things out. And sometimes that means you fail. And then when you fail, you learn next time that you do that. And I think also you can look at the animal kingdom as well. If you look at two dogs in a park, they're not necessarily speaking to each other, but they're playing with each other. That's the language that they use to learn about each other and get to know each other. So for me, play is really a way of helping people lose inhibitions and get into a world or a state of being which allows them to be curious within a set of rules, because that's kind of what games do. They set rules for you. And within those rules, you're allowed to fail. And every time you fail, you learn. And that's kind of what it means to me on one side. And then the other side is fun. And when things are fun, we're engaged, we're motivated, we're excited. And that's really kind of the philosophy that we built into Kahoot.
And so We Are Human is the incubator of which Kahoot was born, and you're now going back to spend some time with We Are Human again. Anyone who's seen a Kahoot video will know how fundamental the idea of play is to its success. But how can educators listening in take some of the building blocks of that design behind Kahoot and apply it to perhaps their own lesson planning or how they actually execute lessons in the classroom or outside of the classroom if they're building flipped learning stuff as well?
Yeah, I mean, for us, it's really about human behavior. It's about people. And that kind of sounds obvious, but there's a process and methodology behind that. We had this phrase that we said that we're focused on how you learn and not what you learn. So for us, that's really about understanding how we can bring engagement, motivation, desire into learning. Because when that happens, that's when every individual has, you know, their chance of unlocking their potential, which is really kind of the motivation behind what we were doing. So a big part of it, I think the best educators in the world know this, is really about bringing emotion into the learning experience. One thing that we did was looked at the behaviors of learners beyond the classroom. So when they're at home, what products do they use? What games do they play? What things excite them and motivate them? And then we tried to design a solution that applied those behaviors within the classroom, because a lot of experiences that we had seen before we started Kahoot within the classroom were generally, there were things you would expect to see in the classroom. And I think that doesn't necessarily motivate young people today, particularly when knowledge and is so readily accessible everywhere and mobile technology is so ubiquitous. So we designed our pedagogy around that. And that pedagogy we called Learners to Leaders. And really, that can actually be applied. It's not just for Kahoot. That's a way of learning. It's a way of thinking. And we would love other people to take that pedagogy on and apply it to their teaching and apply it to their learners' curriculum, because it's about giving them the skills that help them adapt to an ever-changing world and really becoming leaders through that, becoming experts in the things that excite them and motivate them. We designed it based on, as well as a gaming model and a learning model, also a behavioral model. So it's really designed to kind of build in these intrinsic rewards that help people feel success from what they've been attempting to achieve, and gives them the motivation to keep on going.
It's really interesting because I was reading about a school in Russia recently where the model is that the students kind of learn what they need to learn in terms of curriculum fairly rapidly, but that their kind of metric of success is when they become able to teach that to other students. So it becomes like a peer-to-peer model, which I thought was quite interesting in your learner-to-leader idea as well.
Yeah, no, that's exactly the point of it. Kind of the leadership comes in really because, you know, we believe in creativity and giving learners the ability to kind of take things into their own hands. And the pedagogy encourages them to do that in the context of Kahoot. That's through creating games and then taking on the role of the teacher in the classroom and playing that game with their classmates who are learning about the things that they've become an expert in and they therefore become a leader within that subject. But then, of course, they go back into the learner mode and the player mode whilst they're playing games that their classmates have created in different topics that they're experts within. And that's definitely a model that we strongly believe in.
So one question for educators listening in who are, you know, excited about, you know, trialing things in their classroom and taking on this kind of experimental approach to hopefully, you know, have better outcomes in terms of learning. We talked previously about the importance of being humble when you're going about, you know, designing things up, but, you know, also not resting on past assumptions. So do you have any experiences of where things didn't go the way you thought that, you know, will give courage to those that are setting out on experimenting? And part of that will be the inevitable odd failure here or there, where hopefully beyond that is some great successes as well.
Yeah, I mean, failure is something to be completely embraced, because how do you learn? If you get everything right first time, then for me, it's about having an effective process that allows you to learn. And by failing in a way where you've learned early, so you can adapt as you continue to go. And these are, you know, principles that we apply to building businesses as much as designing learning experiences. In the context of actual examples, that's quite a tough one. I mean, Kahoot in itself started out really, you know, myself and Johan and Morten, my co-founders, and later Osmond, who joined, we started out originally not actually applying the human behaviors that are game platform creates wasn't actually directly into learning. We were doing it in more social settings, in cinemas. So in the context of building a business, we were learning about human behavior, but the failure for us was that we weren't applying it in a setting that we really cared about and where we could have real impact on the world. So we, as I mentioned, we tried gaming experiences in cinemas. The same concept as Kahoot, playing games together. We tried it in events and team building in businesses, amongst other things. And the learning for us at that point was we'd invested so much of our energy and effort. We'd developed an amazing technology platform, but we weren't really impacting human behaviors. And after a bit of a heart-to-heart, when we were out in Silicon Valley, that's when we realized our impact on this world is going to be in learning. And that's where we actually pivoted what we were doing and evolved it into the learning setting. And that was where Kahoot was born.
So always being open to new avenues, new ways of applying what you're trying to achieve somewhere.
Yeah, because if you believe that your initial assumption is the only way of doing it, I can guarantee that most of the time you're going to fail anyway, because how do you know until you start to build up evidence that your assumption is correct? And in the world we live in, where people are vying for attention, technology is accessible from anywhere in lots of different forms, and people, at the end of the day, they may on the face of it seem like the same. You know, if as an audience, every teacher is different, for example, every learner is different. And so we invested a lot of time into trying to understand not just the demographic differences, but the motivational differences, the behavioral differences, so we could design a solution that was more nuanced based on them. But without going through that process of really trying to understand our audience and seeing how we could deliver that deep value to them, we would never have learned, and we would have failed straight away.
Well, on the evidence note that you just mentioned, how can educators best measure the impact of play-based learning or a methodology similar to that you've described without phasing out all of the experimentation, which also means that it can go in different directions? So how, I mean, impact is so important these days. So how can we balance the two of them?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously there are kind of standard measurements in schools for, you know, measuring progress. But aside from that, I think, you know, one of the most amazing things about play and games is, like I mentioned before, they often have a set of rules, and the set of rules can actually give you data points. And for me, it's really about understanding individual improvement. But individual improvement, this doesn't always have to be quantitative either. Like, we believe a lot in looking at things qualitatively too. In fact, we measured a lot of Kahoot's impact based on the sentiment that we were seeing in the market from our end user, from learners, from educators around the world. And I think you can actually apply the same philosophy and thinking to the actual learning experience itself from an educator's perspective. You know, one of the biggest things I'm sure is about emotional engagement, and I'm sure you can see a change in emotional engagement at a very individual student level. Are there behavioral changes, such as are they showing more curiosity? Are they investigating more? Are they kind of doing things maybe beyond the classroom that they weren't doing before, which shows a deeper emotional investment from them? Because I really believe when you build that emotional connection, which game-based learning and play-based learning is there to do, then that's really when you can help them find the things that, you know, make them tick, where their potential can really be extracted and help them realize what they could become.
So look at the data, but don't always forget the anecdotal and visual stuff.
Exactly.
As well.
Exactly, because quantitative data can it can be misleading as well. It can lead to not innovating because you do the things that become predictable.
Hmm. What are your favorite games?
Oh, my favorite games. That's a good question. Usually football related. For me, my favorite games are the ones that bring people together. You know, if I look back to when I used to play games a lot more when I was at university, it was about the social bonds that they brought. It was about the experience that you had together with your friends. And to be honest, that is actually the same philosophy we try to bring into Kahoot. It's really about that kind of moment in time, in real time, when people are together and building those kind of social bonds between people. So any game which is social is really my favourite, and I can't help if they're football ones.
Yeah, we had a good chat about football podcasts before, I remember.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, in a more educational context, obviously the Minecrafts of this world do fascinate me because they're encouraging creativity and problem-solving skills, which are kind of core to the Kahoot pedagogy as well. And they're, because what really what you're learning there is a skill set. It's not about knowledge acquisition. It's about building a better person and being able to adapt as the world changes.
And finally, do you have any recommendations of books or resources or people or associations which might inspire people who are listening into this episode as well?
I guess most of the books I read in this kind of context, I apply to business and growth and engagement around the products that we create. But I actually think the methodologies within them, the processes can be applied into learning as well. One of my favorites is called Game Storming. And really it's a set of workshops which are based around a set of rules, like I mentioned before, where you play games. And the point of the games are to understand a context or a scenario, or they're to unlock ideas and create new ideas, or they're to take a whole load of ideas that you've already created and narrow down to the best ones. And quite often we use those processes within kind of our innovation workshops and product design workshops as a way of finding the right solutions or the right hypothesis to go out and test. So I strongly recommend Game Storming. And another one that we talk about a lot is called Hooked by a guy called Nir Eyal. And really that is a model and a process for designing products that become habitual to use. So it's not necessarily directly relevant, but the principles behind it can be applied in a learning setting, because really what it's about is about creating internal intrinsic rewards for individual people for feeling progress and encouraging them to continue and perform more actions and do more things. And if you apply that methodology correctly to learning, basically you're going to have a lot of very engaged learners who are feeling like they are making progress themselves.
Thanks, Jamie. So that's it for today. If you liked our exploration of play-based learning and design, come back in February when we'll be collaborating with LEGO on another episode focused on the maker movement. You can also find out more from LEGO Education at www.education.lego.com. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode and what you're up to in play-based learning. So do drop us a note at podcastedtech@misskyrk, that's K-Y-R-K, at Tom J. Hall and at Jamie Brooker, B-R-O-O-K-E-R, or post on our Facebook or Instagram pages. You can also leave a voicemail for future inclusion at www.speakpipe.com/theedtechpodcast, and we'd love to hear from you. Finally, all the show notes, references and extras for this episode will be included at www.theedtechpodcast.com on the podcast tab, so do go and check that out. Have a great week, everyone, and see you next time.